This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. On September 4th, hundreds of fast food workers were arrested in protests around the country in Philadelphia, Portland, Chicago, New York City. The list goes on. The demonstrations were held to shed light on the low wages many of these employees bring home and to push for an increase in the minimum wage to $15. What would a $15 minimum wage mean to lower-income workers in practical terms? And how would it affect small businesses and franchises? Here to shed some light in the first half hour are Kate Goodman, lead organizer for the group 15 Now Philadelphia, a coalition dedicated to raising the minimum wage to $15. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you so much.
And joining us from New York is Jordan Weissman, senior business and economics reporter for Slate. Hello, Jordan.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Welcome. Well, the minimum wage varies from state to state, but at the federal level, at this point, it's $7.25 an hour. Kate Goodman, let's start with you. Sketch for us, if you would, the challenges faced by someone who is working at, say, the federal minimum wage level.
Sure. I mean, the challenges are myriad, and I want to be clear that Pennsylvania and Philadelphia have the lowest minimum wage in the country. Several of our neighboring states have taken some measure to raise it up, but Pennsylvania and Philadelphia have taken no action whatsoever. You know, a person working a minimum wage job can barely make ends meet. They have no money left over after they pay rent. Many of them are using food stamps, subsidized childcare and healthcare, and are just, you know, going through a lot of challenges every day. Many of them are stuck in those jobs. In order to get a better job, they're looking at taking on heavy debt by going back to school. So, you know, the primary narrative that is going on in these communities is the feeling of being trapped and stuck in these jobs with nowhere to go.
So the president wants to raise the rate to $10.10 an hour, that's the federal rate, and then tie it to an inflation index. That's not enough.
I mean, I think we need to be clear that the president wouldn't be asking for $10.10 if we hadn't seen these mass uprisings around the country for $15. We would have probably been looking at something like $8.50 instead, which I think was on the table before. And no, we don't believe that $10.10 is enough. We at 15 now think that all workers deserve a robust living wage. If wages were tied to inflation and productivity, minimum wage would be $22 an hour. So we don't believe that we want to fight, like, workers don't want to fight for a subsistence wage that they can scrape by on. What really inspires them to fight back and to organize is the $15 an hour call. You know, no one's in the streets demanding $10.10. They're in the streets demanding $15 because that would actually change their lives.
Jordan Weissman, Seattle made headlines this summer when its city council became the first in the nation to raise the rate to $15 an hour, although it will happen over a number of years. A huge risk for the Emerald City?
I do think it's a risk. I want to take a step back, though, and make one thing clear, which is the federal minimum wage is too low. I think we Sarah and I agree about that.
It's been that way for what, 5 years?
Yeah, it's been since the Bush administration. But I think, or no, I can't remember exactly when it hit some, or 2009. Okay, so, but it's been that way for a while. It was too low then. If adjusted for inflation, the minimum wage maxed out actually are somewhere in the range of about $10 in the 1960s, if you adjusted for today's prices. And one of the reasons why I've argued that $10.10 an hour or something around that level is a very good idea is because even if you assume job losses in line with what respectable conservative economists think might happen, it's still a net benefit for workers. Even if you have a small amount of job losses, the amount of money going to workers is going to increase because it's enough people get raises. And so you're doing the most amount of good. And that's what I'm kind of concerned about here, about doing the most amount of good. You know, when you get to $15 an hour, you're getting into sort of an unprecedented range, especially for the United States. I've argued that essentially it would be the highest minimum wage in the world. I've had some very vigorous arguments back and forth because it's surprisingly difficult to compare minimum wages across countries. And what some
Why
people
is
do
that?
Is, Because you, among other things, you have to adjust for prices and how much everything else costs in that country. It's not just because exchange rates don't really tell the whole story. It really gets kind of arcane, and you have to decide what prices to adjust for, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
One thing some people do is they compare the minimum wage to the median wage in the area. And I don't want to go too deep down this rabbit hole. Really, even if you talk to liberal economists, like one named Arundhati Dubey, who's sort of the leader of the kind of new wave of minimum wage research that the left likes to cite, they'll acknowledge that this is very high. And what I really, I the big point, I think, that I want to press is that that it's great that minimum wage activists have changed this debate, but when it comes to actually making policy, we need to think in terms of what's appropriate for each and every city. Is $15 really appropriate for Philadelphia? Is it appropriate for Seattle compared to what people are already making, compared to what's what the local economy looks like?
Okay, I want to get back to Seattle in just a moment, but Kate, why the number 15?
The number 15, I think, came from fast food workers initially organizing in New York, and it kind of caught fire in Seattle when socialist city council member Shama Sawant, who went on to win a city council seat, kind of took up the mantle of 15. So it's been this sort of organic process that I think has surprised labor and even the progressive community.
But how does it fit into budgets? Was it actually a number that was calculated to say, okay, if these folks in general get $15 an hour, this will lift them to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, $15 an hour would be around a $31,000 an hour job for a single wage earning family. And that puts you, you know, you're not driving a Rolls Royce. You're doing the best you can for your family. I mean, many studies in Philadelphia, you know, by housing counselors have or housing councils have shown that in order for a single parent with a two-bedroom house, they'd need to earn at least 17. So we feel that 15 is more than reasonable, and I think we need to be really careful when we use words like appropriate. You know, what's inappropriate is that in Philadelphia, 30% of people live in poverty and 50% of people make less than $15 an hour, while the CEO of McDonald's makes $9,000 an hour. And we live in the richest country in the history of the world, so I think it's actually really exciting if we're looking at what Jordan says is the highest minimum wage in the world. We should have the highest minimum wage in the world.
All right, Jordan, quickly, before we get to the telephones, we were talking earlier about the huge or the risk to Seattle. Is it a huge risk?
I mean, it's not. So I wrote a line at the end of one of my articles about Seattle, making a comment about crashing the economy, and you know, they're taking this idea for a test drive, and some people got mad at me. And the truth is, I don't think Seattle's entire economy is going to fly off its wheels or you know, end up a wreck. But what you are risking is unemployment among, or you're risking a degree of unemployment among a vulnerable population. Beyond that, another thing you're risking is that some amount of what we call job substitution, essentially that a more educated worker from out in the suburbs is going to come down and take a job that might have gone to a poor person who lived in Seattle because the wages are so much better. I mean, there are all these moving factors that some people could end up worse off. And what I just want to address this issue of Philadelphia and the number of people in poverty. Yes, Philadelphia has an incredibly high poverty rate, but that's not all people who are working poor. That a lot of people or a large percentage of the people who are under the federal poverty line do not have a job. And so that is why you need to be very, very careful when you are, you know, essentially when you're making policy that you don't create unintended consequences.
All right, let's get to the phones. Joshua in Society Hill, you're on the air. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks. I just want to know what you say to someone who's a small business owner who's paying $9 and $10 an hour to their employees, who has to shut their business down if the minimum wage is $15. I mean, you're going to create a bunch of unemployed people in that situation. And I'm just wondering what the response is.
All right, Jordan Weissman, why don't you tackle that one?
Yeah, it's a real issue. There was one study by a Federal Reserve economist that found that minimum wage increases don't necessarily lead to less employment. But one thing that they do seem to create, or one thing they do lead to, is more businesses shutting down and then being replaced by ones that are designed a little bit, or that are kind of structured better to deal with that wage. So who knows, you might lose McDonald's and get a Chipotle or a Five Guys that has slightly higher margins. You know, I would expect. So I don't know how many. I mean, I don't know if there's been any estimate in Philadelphia for how many businesses would shut down and be replaced or whatnot. I don't want to, you know, give a number. I'm just making up. But, you know, it's an issue, and it's something you have to confront as a trade-off. It might be, you know, you're going to have to deal with that probably to some degree if you get any kind of a reasonable minimum wage increase, and you just have to decide if, you know, in the big scheme of things, if it's worthwhile. I think some of that I think some of it is worthwhile. It just, how much of it are you willing to tolerate?
And Kate Goodman, let's get your thoughts on that. I mean, you raise the wage, and mm-hmm. some businesses might have to then fire or lay off the employees who might have benefited from the wage.
I mean, I think that sort of alarmism is trotted out every single time we talk about raising the minimum wage. And, you know, big businesses have no problem putting small businesses on the front line as a smokescreen to, like, raise all these fears about what would happen to small businesses. What you don't see is big businesses advocating for small businesses when they're trying to get these giant corporate tax breaks. You know, if small businesses really can't afford to pay $15 an hour right now, what we recommend is that if a $15 an hour minimum wage is implemented, that these businesses open their books to the city, demonstrate that they cannot pay $15 right now, and then, you know, excise a small tax on these large businesses that are getting huge tax breaks to, you know, subsidize working people instead of giant corporations and the super wealthy. So I think it's really a smokescreen, and we've talked to a lot of small businesses, especially like on 52nd Street, we'll talk to barbers. They understand that this like contraction in wealth for the majority of the very poor is resulting in business losses for them. You know, someone who's living in poverty can't afford to buy a backpack or a haircut. So what we're saying is that if you redistribute the way wealth is distributed in the United States, you would actually help small businesses in the long run.
But politically, do you think that's a reality?
I don't think it's our job to decide what's politically a reality, but to fight unapologetically for working class interests and raise the bar for what we expect of our politicians.
Jordan?
I mean, there's a lot to bite off. I want to address this idea of that Sarah kind of hinted at, that you redistribute
Kate, actually.
Wealth and, oh, sorry, Kate. I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Sorry, Kate. That hinted at that. If you redistribute wealth, you're going to, you know, increase spending overall. And again, there's some truth to that. I mean, I think a lot of us, we're kind of in early days yet of this research. The economists are in early days yet, but there's a lot of worry that income inequality is actually hurting consumer spending, for instance, because the rich tend to spend less, a smaller percentage of their income than the working class. And so there is this sense that you can revive local economies essentially by redistributing income down. And I think that there's a little bit of there are signs that there's a little bit of truth to that. You can at least give a temporary pop in spending because people are suddenly going to have money to go out and buy their first car or something if you had a $15 minimum wage. But again, there are so many moving pieces that I'm a little worried about just going up to the number 15. Why not move it up to 11 or 12 first, since you're already at such a low wage in Philadelphia? Why not experiment?
All right, Jordan, on that, I'm going to have to stop you for the moment because we've got a break coming up. We're talking about efforts to raise the minimum wage to $15. Calls are coming in, but you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We will be right back.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. The new Penn Musculoskeletal Center, the region's first, is designed to reflect how your muscles, bones, and joints all work together. With an innovative team approach, orthopedic surgeons, rheumatologists, pain specialists, rehabilitation physicians, and physical therapists work as one to create a treatment plan uniquely for you. More at PennMedicine.org/MSK. The new Penn Musculoskeletal Center, PennMedicine.org/MSK.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day. because it offers something different. WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage, offers a gateway to the arts, and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
Zollner Arts Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY and presents the Princeton Singers, Sunday, September 28th. The Dream Concert, a 30th anniversary celebration, recognized as one of the premier professional chamber choirs in the country. Tickets at ZollnerArtsCenter.org.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we are taking a close look at efforts to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Our guests for this half hour are Jordan Weissman, senior business and economics reporter for Slate, and Kate Goodman is lead organizer for the group 15 Now Philadelphia. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number. It's 888-477-9499. Do you work a minimum wage job? And if so, are you able to make ends meet? Or do you run a small business? How would increasing the minimum wage affect you? As a matter of fact, speaking of calls, let's go to Belmont Hills and welcome Bill to Radio Times. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot. I just wanted to say I'm a middle-class guy. I live in Lower Merion, but I strongly support increasing the minimum wage to at least $15. According to, and here's why, I think the people who earn it are working 40 hours a week at least, and they're not able to make ends meet. And I think that's simply immoral. But there's a related issue, which is ratio of CEO to worker pay. The ratio was 20 to 1 in 1950, and it's over 200 to 1 now. That's according to Bloomberg News. And I want to emphasize this has nothing to do with inflation. This is ratios. And so what we really need to do to redress that, because CEOs don't, you know, get successful on their own, they do it on the backs of their workers, we need to restructure the federal tax code to what it used to be and have much higher taxes on middle-class people, including me, and wealthy people, and therefore return some tax benefits to those on the bottom, including minimum wage people and unemployed.
All right,
and
Bill.
I think this would complement the higher minimum wage, and it would help lower income people even more.
Thanks for the call. Jordan Weissman, the political will to do that at this time?
to increase taxes, right? There's almost never a great time. But you're never going to I appreciate that call because, yes, I would love to see us try to redress some of these inequality issues through the tax code. And one of the most effective policy tools, anti-poverty policy tools we have is something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is essentially, it's just a wage supplement for workers who don't make a lot of money. You know, to the federal government, it's a refundable tax credit. So essentially they send a lot of people a check in the end. And it's great because it's a way, essentially it helps workers without putting too much of, forcing anything too onerous on a lot of businesses. And I would like to see maybe an increase in that as well as a reasonable increase in the minimum wage. I just want to come back to this idea of where the the question of where the number 15 comes from and whether it's appropriate for Philadelphia. You know, it is kind of arbitrary, and I just want to read off a few numbers for you. According to the MIT Living Wage Calculator, a living wage for one adult is $10 in Philadelphia. For one adult and one child, it's $19.68. And for one adult and two children, it's $24.79. $15, it is kind of arbitrary in the end. There's not a lot of science behind it. And I just want people to realize that when we're talking about this, that it's a great political slogan, but there's not a lot of economics behind it.
At the end of the day, if you do see the minimum wage going up, Jordan, where do you think it'll end up?
I think right now Democrats in nationally, I think Democrats in Congress have sort of coalesced around 10-10, which I think is great. I think what studies have been done and have shown that will be a really great net benefit for the country.
And if the minimum wage does go up, what will be the direct effect on the middle class?
A surprising fraction of the beneficiary or of minimum wage earners are essentially middle class people, working class people. It's not people below the poverty line as much as you would think. So it'll be a boost. It'll be good. It will help a lot of working families make ends meet a little easier.
Kate, let's get to your experience a little bit on the front line in the protests. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's been tough to get some minimum wage earners to leave their jobs to join protests outside their establishments. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, these minimum wage workers are people living on the edge. And I do want to respond to Jordan's assertion that 15 is an arbitrary number. We're a working class organization that organizes working people to fight for what they believe they're valued at. Not to kowtow to what, elite economists think that we are valued at. So 15 comes from workers organizing and demanding 15. And we will fight to win what workers are standing up for. And so, yes, it is very difficult to get workers to walk out of their jobs when they're living on the edge, when losing one day's pay could mean the difference between, getting evicted from their houses or something like that. And these are also people who have been highly disenfranchised from the political process. So it takes a lot of work and a lot of training to teach people about community organizing. The predominant narratives of corporate media says that these people are not worth 15, that CEOs are worth $9,000 an hour for sitting behind a desk, but someone flipping burgers isn't worth anything. And so, it's challenging people to, take a stand and say, I'm worth more. And that's a long process, but we're beginning to see the seeds of mass dissent and rising up to demand what we deserve as working class people.
Jordan Weissman, a quick reaction.
Yeah, I really get nervous anytime anyone on the left starts talking about, we don't need to listen to elite economists. There are a lot of the movement for a higher minimum wage is based on the work of economists who said this will kind of pushing back against the conventional wisdom, saying this will not necessarily hurt us if we do it in the right way. I do think we should pay a little bit of attention to social science when there is so much of an opportunity for unintended consequences that could accidentally hurt the very people we are trying to help, and that there should be some amount of caution involved. And yes, people do think they are, do believe they are worth $15, and they should be willing to ask for it. But in the end, also, we're not talking about negotiations. We're talking about a government setting a wage level. And so if they set the wrong one, that could end you could have repercussions that we did not foresee.
Kate, Seattle went for $15 an hour. What realistically would happen in Philadelphia? They're two very different cities, two very different political scenes.
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia is an entirely different city than Seattle. We're going through post-industrial levels of job loss. Wages are lower. There's a much greater population of working class people of color. So, the situation of winning 15 is going to necessitate a mass movement of working class people that wasn't necessarily necessary in Seattle, that penetrated like the more oppressed layers of the working class. So what we're doing in Philadelphia, in order to win 15, understanding that it's going to require a larger mass movement here, minimum wage in Seattle was already 932, is invest more time and energy in building neighborhood-level organizing committees and talking to as many low-wage workers as possible in order to win 15. There are unique challenges here.
So if the wage in Philadelphia were raised to 1010, which is what President Obama wants on the federal level. Would you accept that?
Sure. I mean, that would be a raise for, many people, but it wouldn't be enough. We would continue to fight. And frankly, I doubt that we're going to see 1010 in the near future on a federal level. Federal level legislators, both parties are representing the interests of big businesses. So I don't think that unless we see a significant challenge to Republicans and Democrats on a federal level, will we see either party step up and be able to win 1010, which is why we're organizing on a local level.
Okay, we've got time for a quick email before we switch gears here. Susan emails, what happens to all the administrators and secretaries with college degrees who make 15 to 20 an hour? Should their salaries increase too? Jordan?
This is another question that people deal with constantly. It's called wage compression. Essentially, when you move $15 to the minimum wage, does everyone else's wage move up with it, or does everyone's earnings just get closer together? My guess is they're probably, you would not see a lot of companies suddenly my again, and I'm just speculating here, but if you got a raise to something as high as 15, you're not going to see a lot of offices give a raise to their secretary too, especially since secretaries are slowly being replaced or kind of laid off thanks to things like, you know, better like micro versions of Microsoft Office. So yeah, you're probably going to see some middle class workers making a little bit closer to what someone at McDonald's makes. That might be, or currently middle class workers. That might be a good thing in the end, in some people's opinion. I don't necessarily feel strongly one way or the other about it.
Okay, I'd like to thank Jordan Weissman, senior business and economics reporter for Slate, for joining us this half hour. Thanks, Jordan.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Also, Kate Goodman is lead organizer for the group 15 Now Philadelphia. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
We're going to change focus now. Efforts to raise the minimum wage to $15 and to unionize fast food workers have dovetailed. And joining us now to bring us up to speed on the labor organization piece of the story is William Finnegan. He writes for The New Yorker and recently penned the piece Dignity, Fast Food Workers and a New Form of Labor Activism. William Finnegan, welcome.
Thank you.
So take us behind the scenes in the life of a typical fast food worker. What are the hours like? Do they generally know when they're coming in from week to week? Sketch that for us.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, a good place to start, because it's not just in fast food, but I think in a lot of retail lately, the scheduling, work scheduling, has become a big problem. There's, you know, software developed for crew scheduling. McDonald's, for instance, uses it. I was writing primarily about workers at a McDonald's here in New York City, but so do all the other fast food chains and a lot of other major retail chains use this scheduling software that keeps people kind of off balance. They never know when they're going to work week to week. At the McDonald's I was looking at, they learn on Saturday night what the coming week's schedule is, and many people don't get as many hours as they want to work. The labor scheduling is very careful to keep people under 40 hours so they're not full-time, and certainly so they're not working more than 40 hours when they become legally entitled to overtime. So part of the problem for people at the low end of the wage scale these days is scheduling, and then, of course, the other part is their very low wages. Most people in fast food make minimum wage or very near minimum wage, and that was true of the people I was writing about here in New York, where you know, $8 an hour, which is the minimum wage in New York City, really doesn't go very far, especially if you're only getting 30 hours a week.
Sure. And I'm guessing sick leave, vacation, that's not happening?
No, no benefits.
The fast food giants who have been targeted by the labor movement have fired back that most of their workers are young, they're part-time, maybe they're teenagers, they're not working to support families. Does the industry have a point?
Well, that's been a kind of traditional argument made by the fast food giants for their pay, which has been minimum wage and even in the past, you know, sub-minimum wage. But it's really grown quite threadbare, that argument. I mean, it's true that most of the workers are part-time, but that's not because they want to be part-time. No, they're not young. They're not teenagers. The median age now is 28. More than a quarter of the workers at fast food chains have children. They're supporting families. And it's really problematic. Obviously, these low wages don't allow you to support a family. And so some recent studies show that 52% of fast food workers are also on some form of public assistance.
Mm-hmm.
With that last year, that public assistance came to nearly $7 billion. So activists argue, understandably, that the public, the taxpayer, is basically subsidizing this industry.
So tell us about efforts to unionize fast food workers. The Service Employees International Union has been backing the campaign with funds.
Yeah.
Why don't we start there?
Yeah.
How long has it been going on?
Which is a couple of years now. That's the second largest union by membership in the United States after the Teachers Union. They've been sort of quietly funding this campaign for a couple of years, which first burst into public view in November 2012 here in New York City. A couple of hundred workers from about 40 fast food outlets around the city gathered in Midtown, you know, on Madison Avenue outside of McDonald's one morning. chanting and getting other people to walk off their jobs. They came from Burger King and Wendy's and Taco Bell, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Domino's Pizza, as well as McDonald's. That's when they announced their goals, which were an industry-wide raise to $15 an hour and the right to form a union without retaliation. That spread to the Midwest and to cities around the country over the course of the winter of 2012-2013. By the summer of 2013, workers in 60 cities across the U.S., even in the traditionally anti-union South, were staging coordinated one-day walkouts and marches. And it's just built and built since there. I mean, there have been seven major actions. Each one's been bigger, spread to other countries. It's really getting command quite a lot of press. The question is, you know, how many workers are involved and whether it remains a minority strike. Because these aren't really strikes, of course. They're not shutting down many shops.
But people are leaving their posts, correct?
People are leaving their posts, yeah, but most of the shops are staying open, and it's not as if they're trying to, you know, discourage strike breakers. It's not a classic strike. These are wildcat strikes, and so far the management hasn't really budged.
I was just going to say, what has been the reaction of the fast food industry? It's been a couple of years, you said?
Yeah, it's been almost 2 years. I think they've been pretty clumsy with, you know, the public relations part of it. They seem to be quite wrong-footed by all this. And they primarily let the trade association, known as it's the National Restaurant Association, sometimes known as the other NRA, kind of handle the response. And they've been pretty dismissive. Their press releases say, you know, this is nothing more than big labor's attempt to push their own agenda. When I spoke to the NRA, their chief spokesman said that a lot of these protests are actually just organizers. He said, quote, "There's often not one restaurant worker to be found among the crowds of organizers," unquote. But I've been to a number of these in New York and elsewhere. I went to a conference of this movement in Chicago, and I can say from personal experience, it's workers. I mean, there are plenty of organizers around, but the bulk of the protesters are workers.
But if the food industry isn't budging, then what does the campaign need to do to move the process forward?
Well, I'd say the pressure is rising on them, there are various fronts to this. The labor movement, the SEIU, likes to say and think they're kind of coming out of the shadows now and being more public about their support and their role in this, likes to imagine a kind of coming to the table, you know, the big three burger chains, McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, are going to finally sit down and negotiate with the sort of, you know, representatives of the workers, but it's hard to actually see that coming soon. I mean, the movements, the campaigns in New York, it's called Fast Food Forward, and in Chicago it's Fight for 15. In every city, I don't know what it's called in Philadelphia, but every city has its own campaign going, and they get together, as I say, in these sort of national conferences. But those aren't bargaining units, you know. They more represent what's sometimes called alt labor, the kind of community groups and workers centers that have emerged in to kind of fill the vacuum. I mean, organized labor has greatly declined over the long haul. They're down to 7% of private sector workers.
And I'd like to touch on that after the break, but we'll be back in just a moment here on Radio Times. William Finnegan is our guest this half hour. He writes for The New Yorker, and we're talking about the efforts to unionize fast food workers. If you'd like to call us, 888-477-9499. This is Radio Times.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute for Cognitive Behavior Therapy. Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck welcome new clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Beck Institute is committed to providing effective, problem-focused, and compassionate treatment for issues such as anxiety, depression, stress, and weight management. To learn about cognitive behavior therapy or to schedule an appointment, beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
The new biopic, Jimi, Always By My Side, is about Jimi Hendrix from 1966 to 67 when he lived in London and transformed himself from Jimi James into Jimi Hendrix. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the film's writer and director, John Ridley, who won an Oscar for writing 12 Years a Slave, and Andre Benjamin of the group Outkast, who plays Jimi Hendrix. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Striking at ISIS in Syria. The first test of President Obama's coalition fighting the latest Middle Eastern threat and a new one. The Pentagon says there's more to worry about besides ISIS in Syria. Jihadists from Al-Qaeda back in the game. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Muskowain. We're talking about the movement to organize fast food workers in this country. Where's it going? And is it breathing new life into organized labor? William Finnegan is our guest. He writes for The New Yorker and recently wrote the piece Dignity, Fast Food Workers and a New Form of Labor Activism. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. And the number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or a tweet at whyyradiotimes. And William, before the break, we started to talk about this, but there's a perception in this country that the labor movement has been somewhat marginalized. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think it is, historically. I mean, when you think of the sort of progress made in labor rights and in wages, the number of jobs that went from being manual labor jobs, even poverty jobs, become middle class jobs in the auto industry and many other industries in the 20th century. I mean, that was labor unions were central to that movement, and they've become relatively marginalized at this point. As I was saying before the break, the density of labor representation is down to 7% in the private sector. So,
and the food service movement is helping to revitalize it.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which is funding this fast food campaign, they've got more than 2 million members. They're the second biggest union, and they've probably done the best job among large unions of adapting to the new workplace. I mean, the landscape of American business has completely changed. You know, we've shifted from a manufacturing economy to a service economy in the last generation or two, but for the most part, unions haven't changed with it. And SEIU is, as I say, has been adapting. I mean, they've organized healthcare workers and janitors in circumstances that really don't allow for traditional industrial organizing. It's tough. You've got to be original. And these are people in what an economist in a recent book that I like called The Fissured Workplace, describes as fissured workplace that, it's very, very hard to do shop-by-shop organizing. For instance, in fast food, it's very hard to picture what the end game of this is going to look like. Mm-hmm. You can't see really, a shop floor union vote in presided over by the National Labor Relations Board in fast food restaurant after restaurant. I mean, McDonald's alone has 14,000 in the United States. It's not going to work that way.
Sure. All right. We've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. So let's get to them. Eric in South Philly, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, guys.
Good morning. Welcome.
My question is, I work in South Philadelphia. I work at a restaurant. I'm a tips earner. I'm on several forms of federal assistance. I'm trying to raise a family, drive myself into debt. Are we part of the dialogue? Are we part of the exchange with this? We make $2 and something an hour and plus tips. Where do we fit into this?
William Finnegan?
In what I've read and heard, you and your colleagues in that situation are very much part of the dialogue. The proposal to raise a minimum wage, the federal minimum wage currently $7.25 an hour. There's been a bill in rattling around Congress for nearly 2 years now to raise it to $10.10 an hour. Also includes a provision for tip earners who have this impossibly low minimum wage, which is supposed to be made up by tips. and it's to more than double that is the proposal, and generally bring tip earners into the kind of visible economy, because it's kind of shameful the way that employment is being handled legally. But alas, at the moment, there's very little chance. I mean, although raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour polls very, very well. I mean, a large majority of Americans support that raise, something like 73% to 25%. Nonetheless, this Congress, particularly the Republican-led or Republican majority House of Representatives, has no interest in heeding that public support and in passing a minimum wage. So it's quite stuck legislatively right now.
We appreciate the call to Radio Times, Eric. Let's go to Stephanie in Schwanksville, Pennsylvania. Hello, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't mean this to sound callous, and I work two part-time jobs, and I make an average of less than $15 an hour. So I don't say this at all from a pedestal, but I just feel as though these jobs weren't intended to support families. They were intended, you know, for students or part-time workers. And just because some people have families, I don't feel that it's the employer's burden to pay what these people, you know, need. It's kind of us as employees to make ourselves more valuable to an employer.
Thanks, Stephanie, for the call. And Stephanie's perception is a common one, William.
Yeah, I wonder what it means, though, to say that these jobs weren't intended to support a family. I mean, I think that's what, you know, automakers said when there was the movement for the 8-hour day and the 40-hour work week and the campaign to make those jobs pay well enough to support a family. What does it mean to say they weren't intended? I mean, these are businesses. They're making billions in profits. Why should their jobs not support a living wage? I think really the question should be framed in the opposite way. They can say all these jobs are intended for teenagers who are just looking for gas money, but that's not who's taking the jobs. There is a very, very difficult economy in which, as it sounds like the caller understands all too well, people need to work a couple of jobs, and the old idea that jobs in fast food are just for teenagers is just that. It's an old idea. I mean, the McJobs, as people sometimes call them, are often the only jobs available. So why not put the question the opposite way and say, let us make these living wage jobs?
William, a couple moments ago you mentioned janitors. Take us back to the 1990s and the Justice for Janitors campaign. Janitors who generally work for small cleaning companies were fissured, as franchises are. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, that's an example that SEIU sometimes pulls out when you ask, you know, how are you going to get this done? They say, well, look at the Justice for Janitors campaign. There you also had an industry that had changed, like as you have franchising in fast food, so that you have, you know, an owner operator who is actually responsible for labor and for wages, and you have big corporations like McDonald's that are able to say, we're not setting this low wage. It's the, you know, speak to the franchisee who actually has no room to maneuver, doesn't have a profit margin that allows him to do very much because he's in this tight franchise contract with the corporate parent. So in buildings, you had in commercial property, you had a tremendous amount of subcontracting going on, such that you had small employers who would say the same thing, basically. There was nothing they could do. Well, this Justice for Janitors campaign was quite unorthodox and innovative, and they did a lot of civil disobedience, closing freeways in Los Angeles, blocking bridges into Washington, D.C., trying to get building owners to the table. And in time, they succeeded. They really improved the labor conditions for janitors in a lot of places. But it was a different sort of movement because big city janitors historically had been unionized, and in cities like New York, they always have been. They never lost that. But their fight was really to reorganize and rebuild, and there's no comparable history in fast food. The fast food workforce is just gigantic now. It's just under 4 million and growing. And the main companies are so rich and powerful that the stakes are actually much higher in this labor struggle than in any other in recent memory.
Well, let's get into fast food franchises a little more deeply. McDonald's has essentially, I think you say, washed its hands of the labor practices of its franchisees, which you say operate nearly 90% of its stores in the U.S.
That's right.
And over the summer, the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board ruled that McDonald's is a joint employer with its franchisees. So what does this mean to the process?
Well, that's quite a blow to McDonald's. I mean, they'll fight this ruling quite hard and its implementation, you know, both on their own behalf and on behalf of other major franchisors, because this is a very, very common business model now, not only in fast food. And basically, this ruling says that through that standard franchise contract, which is so tight, that the pay and treatment of workers is in fact very largely determined by the corporate parent. Now, if that ruling holds, it is going to completely change the picture, where the big corporations like McDonald's are going to have to deal directly with workers and ultimately perhaps with unions. I mean, it's really brightened the prospects for unionization.
Sure, but now this Labor Relations Board ruling only applies to McDonald's, correct?
Yes, it's in response to a set of complaints. They're also dealing with a set of lawsuits filed, class action lawsuits in three states, California, Michigan, and New York, alleging wage theft and other violations of labor law. So there's a lot on the table just to do with McDonald's right now at the NLRB. But as I say, the implications are industry-wide and reach into other industries as well, because if this holds, if the corporations are in fact joint employers with responsibility for the employees, then it's a whole new ballgame.
So then if it does stand, then perhaps we might see McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, et cetera, at the bargaining table.
Yeah, it becomes much more foreseeable than it was, you know, a few months ago. And that's this pressure. I mean, it's hard to picture the end game, but the pressure of this movement, which is still, as one labor historian put it to me, more air war than ground war. I mean, you don't have millions of people walking off the job. You have thousands, and it's not clear yet. It's not going to be traditional industrial organizing, but the pressure ratchets up. You know, it's political pressure. President Obama gave a shout out to the fast food workers in his Labor Day address in Milwaukee. I mean, they're really catching the public imagination, I think, and people are quite sympathetic on the whole.
Let's take a look at a much smaller company, the In-N-Out Burger chain, which is primarily located in the southwest of the country. It starts its workers at $11 an hour, and full-timers receive a full benefits package. What are they doing differently?
Yeah, it's not a franchise operation. I'm actually from Southern California, so I'm quite familiar with In-N-Out Burger. It's a big local favorite. That's where it started, and it's now got 295 restaurants, mainly in California and the southwest, as you say, and they're taking the high road with their employees. They always have. I mean, it's family owned, as I say, no franchises, and they have always paid a much better wage than other fast food chains, and they get much higher productivity, you know, employee loyalty, and so on as a result. And their burgers are actually better and cheaper. It can be done. Yes, cheaper. I was just looking at I did a kind of back of the envelope comparison. This double burger and the Big Mac, and you know, how much are these things, and what do you really get? And they seem to be cheaper than McDonald's. I mean, that's not scientific. And they're, as I say, they're quite good. There are other examples of companies and even countries that take the high road. I mean, McDonald's is all over the world. It's in 114 countries. So it's a huge multinational. But in each country, it needs to, you know, negotiate different agreements. And in Denmark, for instance, McDonald's workers over the age of 18 start at more than $20 an hour.
Yeah.
And they're unionized, and McDonald's does fine there, and the price of a Big Mac's only 35 cents more than it is in the U.S. It's just a different business model. Things could be done quite differently here as well.
All right, William, we have just enough time to take a telephone call as we head to the top of the hour. Joseph in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, you are live. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. Yes, I want to thank you for participating. And I have a, speaking of people who take the high road, there have been some revivals of older business models like cooperatives, especially in the Philadelphia, New York area. And through working with a community to write a cooperative business model, we've asked ourselves the questions of, you know, what is our ideology? What is our ethic? How can we treat workers? Talk about how people who are starting new businesses can take the high road.
William? Any thoughts?
It depends, obviously, very much on your business and the economics of it. I'm struck by how many, since I've been looking at the restaurant business and talking to the trade association, the National Restaurant Association, as it's called, for restaurants, who they say they represent, they have nearly 500,000 members, and I have no reason to doubt them, but their work seems very much dictated. I mean, their strategic thinking by these big, big restaurant chains, mainly fast food chains, but also full restaurant chains. And they advocate for a kind of low-wage model, and yet they have lots of members, you know, small restaurants, often just single restaurants, where the model is, if not a co-op, as the caller describes, nonetheless, a kind of profit-sharing, productivity-encouraging, you know, highest possible wage model that consistently turns out to, you know, all things being equal, that is, business is well-run and well-situated, to be more successful than this you know, squeeze every penny out kind of poverty wage model.
All right. I guess we'll end the show on a positive note. Thank you so much, Joseph, for the call to Radio Times. And William Finnegan, it was a pleasure.
Thanks. My pleasure.
William Finnegan writes for The New Yorker and is author of the piece Dignity, Fast Food Workers, and a New Form of Labor Activism. For more on Radio Times, visit our Facebook page. And you can also find our podcasts by checking out our homepage, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks for joining us. Hour 2 is on the way.